HRN has a brand new look, but we're sharing the same delicious stories. Invest in the future of food radio by becoming a monthly sustaining member at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Welcome to Pizza Quest. I'm Peter Reinhardt, a man on a never-ending search for the perfect pizza. This show is the audio version of the Pizza Talk YouTube series, where I engage in interesting conversations with some of the country's greatest pizza makers and other artisans. Thanks for joining me on this quest. Welcome to Pizza Talk. I'm Peter Reinhardt, and I am here today with a very special episode of Pizza Talk because it's not about pizza, but it's about, in a sense, what underlies all great pizza, which is fermentation. And we are here with the fermentation guru of the of what I'll call the fermento movement, Sandor Katz, sometimes known as Sandor Kraut, if I'm not mistaken. You still go by that old nickname?
Absolutely. Happy to be with you today.
It's great to have you. I've been looking forward to this for a long time because you are the answer man for me when it comes to anything having to do with fermentation. And those of us who make pizza doughs, of course, and dough, know that that's a small part of the fermentation world. And your book, The Art of Fermentation, which is your more recent book, and I think of The Art of Fermentation as sort of the Bible of fermentation, but you wrote an earlier book called Wild Fermentation, which is like maybe almost 20 years ago, 17, 18 years ago, which when it came out was called the Bible of fermentation. So which one's the real Bible here?
Well, you know, I mean, I really would reject calling either one of them a Bible. I mean, you know, one of the things that...
It's nice when other people say it.
Yeah, it's fine for other people to say it. But, you know, I mean, I would never say it and I would argue with people because, I continue to learn about fermentation. I was 30 years old before I started investigating the realm of fermentation. Fermentation is almost an infinite realm of human cultural experience and wisdom. So, I am just constantly learning about different fermentation processes that I knew nothing about or, new aspects of fermentation processes that I've been working with for many years. And, I am fully aware and have tried to really state outright in my books that they're not comprehensive at all. You know, mm-hmm. they're my attempt to share some of what I have been able to learn with other people and try to make fermentation more accessible and less intimidating for people. But, you know, I have an ongoing learning curve and, anyone who gets deeply involved, whether it's with, baking and sourdough and learning how to work with, you know, that aspect of fermentation or, you know, that's not the only aspect of fermentation involved in a pizza, whether it's cheese making, whether it's, you know, curing meats, in every realm of fermentation, the process will become your teacher. And, you know, you will keep on learning things. And I would imagine that, you know, even you with your sort of, you know, decades and decades of experience as a baker, feel like you develop more nuanced understandings of it as time goes on. I'm happy that my books have been able to sort of demystify things for people and, make this process accessible and not scary for people. But, I am fully aware that, you know, my books are not comprehensive and, that they're imperfect I'm always learning new things, which is part of
it. I think that that's why they are so popular is that they do demystify something that for many people did seem so mysterious and so intimidating and maybe even for some people fearful because we don't think of fermenting bread dough as necessarily something that's scary, but when you talk about fermenting, you know, cabbage and fermenting vegetables and fermenting fruits and fermenting everything else or cheeses or meats, we get into these realms where it seems like there's always these few people that know how to do it. And then there's the rest of us who we get to eat it, but we don't know how to do it, but we want to know how, but we're afraid and we don't know where to start. And that's, I think, you know, one of the great services and why your books are working for people is that you make it accessible and you give them a ramp into the super highway of this huge category of fermentation. I mean, we spoke a couple of years ago at the same conference, the Fermentation Festival in Wisconsin. And it was amazing how many different subgroups there were of speakers from, you know, I was speaking from the bread side. You were the keynote speaker, so you really got to cover the whole topic. But then there were people that were doing kimchi. There were people that were doing sauerkraut. There were people that were doing beverages. You name it. There was a breakout group for everything. So maybe if we could, well, we're going to talk about fermentation. Let's get deep into fermentation in a little bit, because we've got two segments today that we'll have time to explore with. But can you give us a little bit more of the sort of the ramp up for you on how you got into this and how you became so immersed in the world of fermentation?
Well, sure. I would say that my interest in fermentation developed in several different stages. And, you know, the first stage would be as a kid growing up in New York City, I loved pickles. My grandparents were immigrants from Eastern Europe. And, the kinds of pickles that I grew up eating are not the vinegary pickles that we find on contemporary supermarket shelves, but rather, right. You know, cucumbers fermented in a brine with garlic and dill and chili and other kinds of spices. And I didn't know anything about how they were made, but I knew that I loved this flavor and that, you know, some of the other pickles that I would sometimes, I never met a pickle I didn't like, but like I really loved the lactic acid flavor of the pickles that I grew up
in. And, right. In fact, I called them barrel pickles, and we loved to go to the market and be able to just kind of fish for them almost like bobbing for apples.
Yeah, totally, totally. That's the old world way of doing it. Harder to find these days. Pickles out of an open barrel. I spent a couple of years in my mid-20s following a macrobiotic diet, and macrobiotics really places an emphasis on the digestive benefit of pickles and other kinds of live fermented foods. And so during this time, I just observed that these pickles that I'd been eating my entire life, whenever I would eat them, I could feel the salivary glands under my tongue squirting out saliva. And I really began to associate these foods in a very tangible way with getting my digestive juices flowing. And so I started, you know, really seeking out, pickles and sauerkraut and other kinds of fermented foods, almost as like a health practice. But I still wasn't making them myself. The catalyst to begin learning how to ferment myself was that in 1993, I moved from New York City to rural Tennessee. And among the changes in my life, I took up gardening. And I was such a naive city kid, it had never really occurred to me that in a garden, you know, all of the cabbages would be ready at about the same time. All of the radishes would be ready at about the same time. So, when I was faced with this reality of, agricultural cycles, this light bulb went off in my head. And I realized that, you know, fermentation had some role in preservation. And I decided we had a beautiful row of cabbage. And I decided to look into how to make sauerkraut. I had a vague understanding that sauerkraut was regarded as a strategy for preserving cabbage. And, I looked in the joy of cooking. I learned how to make sauerkraut from the joy of cooking. And
funny how many of us learned how to cook from that book. That book was so foundational. It certainly was my first, cookbook sort of breakthrough. Yeah.
So, once I made my first batch of sauerkraut and I couldn't believe how easy it was, it was incredibly delicious. It just made me want to experiment. Like, that's easy to do with cabbages. Can I do that with radishes? I just started, playing around with fermenting different vegetables. I found a little book about making country wine and I made some elderberry wine and some blueberry wine. I started learning about sourdough and started my first sourdough starter. I started making yogurt. It just sort of opened this rabbit hole of fermentation that I had yet to come out of. It was a personal obsession for some years, and I got a little reputation, among my neighbors and friends for being the one who always shows up with sauerkraut, hence the nickname Sandor Kraut. And then I got invited to.
I'm sorry. I think you referred to yourself at one point as a fermentation fetishist.
Yeah. When I published Wild Fermentation, I was using that. Now I prefer to call myself a fermentation revivalist because I've been doing is, you know, just sharing these simple ancient techniques with people. And, you know, just to get back to this idea of like the fear that people have, I mean, I don't think people always had that. I think that, you know, that developed as a manifestation of the war on bacteria. So, you know, we didn't specifically know about bacteria until the 19th century. And, you know, sort of the first investigations into bacteria were actually, you know, on behalf of the winemaking industry. That's how, you know, Louis Pasteur was sort of hired to investigate fermentation and began to, you know, identify yeasts and bacteria and distinguish between different organisms and cultivate them in an isolated way. But then the early triumphs of microbiology really involved identifying pathogenic bacteria. And then in the public imagination, you know, throughout the 20th century, bacteria became associated primarily with, you know, danger and disease and death. And, you know, so for many people, the idea of cultivating bacteria in your kitchen seems like a very scary proposition. You know, how do I know that I have good bacteria that are going to, you know, improve my digestion and, mm-hmm. and make the cabbage safe to eat for a long time rather than some dangerous pathogen that might, you know, make me sick or even kill somebody? So, you know, people just began to project all of their anxiety about bacteria onto the process of fermentation.
Interesting.
Even though fermentation really is ultimately a strategy for safety, and none of these foods would have sort of stood the test of time if they were like playing Russian roulette. Like they all are strategies that enhance the safety of them. And in fact, you know, sauerkraut is safer than raw cabbage.
Because why?
Well, I mean, we read every year about food poisoning outbreaks related to raw vegetables. In the last few weeks, it's been red onions. You know, one year it was cabbage, one year it was lettuce, one year it was tomatoes. Like, clearly there is a possibility of raw vegetables, you know, being contaminated by some pathogenic bacteria. Generally, the story is a factory farm uphill, manure washes down over the vegetables and ends up in the food supply making people sick. But if you were to take those red onions, you know, chop them up, salt them, get them submerged under their juices, lactic acid bacteria will dominate every single time over the incidental pathogens. And as they acidify the environment, what's so elegant and convenient about this strategy for food safety is that, you know, the lactic acid bacteria are going to dominate every time. And as they acidify the environment, they will destroy the pathogens. None of the known pathogens can tolerate an acidic environment.
So basically, if E. coli is the bad guy, during the fermentation process, E. coli is dominated by these other, what we'll call the good bacteria, and they essentially wipe them out and make the food safe?
Well, I mean, it's more that the lactic acid bacteria, and I try to shy away from calling bacteria good or bad. I don't really think that we know enough to categorize them in that way. But the lactic acid bacteria dominate every time. And it's not that they kill the salmonella or the coliform bacteria. It's that they produce acids. So they change the environment to something that those other bacteria can't tolerate.
Interesting. Okay, that gives me a better picture. So yeah, because I always think of it as sort of like the good guys duking it out with the bad guys, and the good guys dominate and win. But it's actually because they create, and this is part, I guess, of fermentation that, and because a lot of our audience are bread bakers and pizza makers, and so they think of it from the dough side. It's really about creating conditions that that eventually result in a certain kind of flavors, but ultimately also a cleaner food in that sense.
Well, I mean, everything about fermentation is about creating selective environments. And so You know, everything we could possibly eat, every grain of wheat, every cabbage, every soybean, every grape, you know, is populated by elaborate communities of organisms. And, you know, what will develop really depends almost entirely on environment. And so, you know, for instance, in fermenting vegetables, like generally the environmental imperative is to get the vegetables submerged. If you leave a bowl of cabbage loosely shredded in a bowl, it's not going to turn into sauerkraut and molds are going to develop. We've all seen these molds when we left like half of a cabbage in the drawer in the refrigerator for a week. You know, it develops this sort of dark, slightly fuzzy bowl that you just slice off and use the rest of the cabbage. But if you leave a bowl of cabbage loosely shredded, that will develop on all of the cut surfaces. And in hot, humid weather, it could turn into a like a cloud of mold that could reduce the cabbage to a puddle of slime that bears no resemblance to delicious, crunchy sauerkraut. So, yeah. I mean, it's always a matter of creating conditions. I mean, you know, it took me a long time in working with my sourdough and learning how to bake with my sourdough to realize that less is more. That by using a smaller proportion of starter in a larger proportion of fresh water and flour, mm-hmm. I'd get a very different kind of a dough developing. And the reason is that you're lowering acidity and really making it possible for the yeast to flourish. Whereas if you just add a large amount of starter to a small amount of fresh material, you'll maintain a high acid environment and it'll be great for the lactic acid bacteria and you'll get an extremely sour loaf of bread. And there are styles of bread like that. But you know, in every realm of fermentation, you're manipulating the environment in order to encourage the growth of certain organisms and simultaneously discourage the growth of others.
So I find this fascinating because on the one hand, we're talking about the effect of the fermentation, the bacterial fermentation. The results of that are acidification, which essentially create flavors and also kind of control, you know, the dominant organisms that are there. But then there's the other side of fermentation that we hear a lot about, which is the health benefits. It's not just preserving the food and making it taste better, but actually it's supposed to be better for us. And that comes back to bacteria again, right? Because now we're affecting our microbiome or our gut, and we're infusing it with bacteria that seem to be as good for us internally as they are for the food that we're eating. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, probiotics and, you know, the bacteria in the food are one, you know, way in which fermentation enhances the health value of food, but it's not the only way. You know, and like, okay, if you compare a sourdough loaf of bread to a loaf of bread that's, you know, risen for 2 hours with a pure yeast starter, you're going to have much higher levels of minerals in the sourdough loaf because the bacterial fermentation breaks down these chemical bonds that called phytate bonds that sort of prevent us from accessing the minerals in the grains. And so, you know, another major nutritional benefit of fermentation is pre-digestion. It makes nutrients more easily bioavailable. It generates additional B vitamins and in certain cases, K vitamins. It generates these, you know, unique byproducts like, you know, sauerkraut. Other fermented vegetables have these compounds called isothiocyanates that are regarded as anti-carcinogenic and they develop as a metabolic byproduct during the fermentation. So, I mean, the probiotics are really important and, you know, I mean, you know, for all of us who grew up in the 20th century, you know, we never heard a good word about bacteria. Nobody ever suggested that there were benefits to bacteria. But, you know, I think, you know, science and medicine are you know, really coming to regard, you know, that the trillion bacteria each of us is host to are, you know, incredibly important to our, you know, how our body regulates itself and to all of the systems of our bodies, including our brain chemistry. And so, you know, there's a growing recognition that, you know, the diminished biodiversity that we all have because of exposure to chemicals and because of our lower fiber diets mm-hmm. is diminishing our health. And, probiotics as well as prebiotics, which are fibers and other kinds of nutrients that take the entire length of our digestion to break down and therefore feed the bacteria of our large intestines. That these can really be enhancements to our health. And eating bacteria-rich foods can help to, restore lost biodiversity and potentially improve digestion, immune function, and, many other aspects of our well-being.
This opens up like a whole realm of questions for me. But going back first to the sourdough, one is, so this would explain your description of what's going on in the sourdough, and especially that breakdown of the phytic acids or the phytics that are preventing us from absorbing the nutrition in it would help to explain why sourdough bread has started to become, again, re-realized, revitalized as a healthier way or a better way of eating bread, right? Makes it.
That's one aspect. I think another aspect is that bacterial fermentation breaks down gluten. So a well-fermented loaf is just going to have less gluten. I mean, if you have celiac disease, it's not going to make it zero gluten. And, from a baker's perspective, you need some of the gluten to, give the dough its cohesiveness.
Yeah.
From a health standpoint, with so many people having, reactions to gluten, it seems like, the perfect storm of, wheat breeding to enhance gluten and, using pure yeast and leaving out the bacteria that breaks down some of the gluten, have led, and probably the diminished biodiversity in our gut, which has diminished many people's ability to break down gluten on their own, have just created this huge broad crisis of gluten intolerance. And, well-fermented bread just has less gluten than bread that's fermented just by yeast. I mean, in terms of sourdough, I think everything is superior about sourdough bread. I mean, it has, it has more flavor complexity. It stays fresh for longer. It has, better nutrition. Everything's better about it. The only thing is it takes longer, and we live in a world where time is money. And it takes more experience. It takes more training. It's easier to make bread with a packet of yeast than maintaining a starter.
And it's been kind of revolutionary in the bread baking community over the last few years. In fact, I have a bread symposium that I put on every year at Johnson & Wales. And the catchphrase of the symposium is because the subject we discuss is the future of bread. Because very often you hear comments like bread is dead, and bread's the enemy and all this other stuff. So the exploration is the future of bread. And the catchphrase is that the future of bread lies in its past, which means, again, going back to those earlier fermentation models before commercial yeast came along that made things go a lot faster. So that helps explain that, I think, a lot.
I think a lot of people just imagine sourdough as some, foofy subset of bread. But, until, some point in the early 20th century, all bread was sourdough bread. I mean, not that that was the only technique that people used, but sourdough in the sense of natural leavening by a broader community of organisms. Singular microorganisms were invented by Louis Pasteur. He's the first person who ever isolated yeast and any other kind of organism. All traditional fermentations of every kind, not only of bread, but of beer, of wine, every tradition of fermentation involves mixed communities of organisms, because that's how microorganisms exist, on all the food substrates that we ferment, is as these communities that include yeasts, but also include bacteria, and they can work synergistically very well together.
Yeah, this is, it's exciting, Kat. It's exciting to even think about these ideas. And again, when you connect the dots and you go, so Pasteur was a hero for saving millions and millions of lives because he was able to, through pasteurization, so to speak, that grew out of his work, destroy maybe organisms that were hurting people. And at the same time, the other side of that coin was that it sent us down a path of, as you say, single organism fermentations, and that, like, for instance, raw milk cheese is clearly superior to pasteurized milk cheese, because it, for the same reasons you said, the community of organisms creating these more complex flavors, and ultimately really taking care of their own, taking care of making the food safe, as opposed to what Pasteur was fighting against, was making the food that was dangerous. Maybe milk that was laying around that people were drinking that had been contaminated by the wrong kind of organisms. So
let me just say one thing about that, because, yeah, you know, I mean, yeah. Pasteur never applied this process to milk. I mean, he developed this process for winemaking. You know, it was a way to sort of kill the, you know, indigenous organisms of the grape juice and then seed it with this sort of selected one. I mean, you know, historically, milk was not a problem. Milk became a problem as a result of industrialization and more people in less space, more and more cows in less space. And so once you take cows off of pasture, they cannot possibly stay healthy. And so, you know, it's in the late 19th and early 20th century that you start seeing these big problems with the milk supply. And yeah, pasteurization was a great salvage protocol, but, you know, there's nothing intrinsically dangerous about raw milk. If you have, you know, raw milk from cows that have adequate access to pasture or goats or sheep, yeah, you know, it's not a safety issue at all. And when that milk gets old, it becomes acidic. It's dominated by lactic acid bacteria. It becomes, you know, fermented sour milk. We have a word in English, clabbered milk. That's just because nobody had a refrigerator until the 20th century. That's right. Just milk that sat on the counter for a few days and began to acidify.
Well, this is, as we say, a huge subject and a fascinating one for me. Let's take a little break here. When we come back, Sander, if you would show us maybe some of the little projects you've got going, some of the various foods that you've been fermenting, maybe we'll talk a little bit about them, maybe give a few tips to our viewers on how they might be able to get into all of this themselves if they're not already doing it. Some of them may be already making kombucha. Everybody who's watching has probably made bread and bread dough, but now we're seeing that that's just the tip of the iceberg of what fermentation is all about. So for those of you who are watching, come back for part two of our conversation with Sandor Katz or Sandor Kraut, the fermentation master that is opening up kind of a whole world of understanding for us today. We'll see you back on part two with Sandor on Pizza Talk.
Stick around for more Pizza Quest after a word from our sponsor.
HRN is excited to unveil the new look of Food Radio. We have a new brand identity and a new website. Our site makes it easier than ever to discover new podcasts and dig through our archive of over 16,000 episodes. You know, it's been 11 years since HRN started broadcasting Food Radio, and we've made it this far thanks to the support of our global listening community. It's because of member donations that Pizza Quest with Peter Reinhardt is on the air, along with 40 other weekly shows. Your contributions gave HRN the security we needed to stay on the airwaves during the pandemic and are allowing us to reopen our studio. Becoming a monthly sustaining member of HRN shows me how much Pizza Quest with Peter Reinhardt and Food Radio means to you. At HRN, we're investing in the future of Food Radio. To do the same, become a monthly sustaining member of HRN. A gift of $5 or $10 a month gives our community the consistent stability it needs to keep the voice of America's food movement alive and thriving. Become a monthly sustaining member at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
We're back with Sandor Katz, coming to us from Eastern Tennessee. So are you like in a mountain area there, Sandor?
Well, I'm actually not in Eastern Tennessee. I'm in Middle Tennessee.
Middle Tennessee. At the
geographical center of the state, southeast of Nashville.
Oh.
Not really in the mountains. I mean, it's very hilly where I live. Like sometimes people call it the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains.
Ah, okay. So Tennessee, for a New Yorker to be transplanted to Tennessee, but you've been there a long time now. You're probably as much a Tennessean as you are a New Yorker.
Well, you know, sometimes when I go back to New York, people think I have a Southern accent, but nobody here would ever mistake me.
No, but you don't have a New York accent. So that's, you know, that's something. It's hard to take. I think as a guy from Philly, you know, I feel like it's hard to take the East Coast out of anybody. No matter how long you move away from the East Coast, it's hard to take it out of you. You know, you're still rooted in the foods of where you grew up and the culture and even the accents of those areas. So we've been talking about fermented foods, and I know you've got all sorts of things going. Why don't you take us through some of those, and I'm sure it'll trigger some more questions.
Well, sure. Okay. So, I mean, first of all, I have to say that I have been having just a bumper crop of cucumbers this
wow.
year.
Wow.
And, you know, these are the classic garlic dills that I grew up with. And I've been eating a lot of them this summer. And then I've also been making this like cucumber kimchi. So it's just, you know, it's also a pickled cucumber, but, you know, rather than just a salty garlicky brine, you know, that has chili pepper and, ginger and shallots and, a little bit of fish sauce. And so, you know, it's a, you know, slightly more, you know, complex, stronger flavor.
Well, it's still
a pickle.
It's a pickle. So, but let's talk about the first one you held up. It seemed, at least on the screen, that it was kind of a cloudy-ish brine. Is that anything that?
Yeah, sure.
Is that normal? And is that anything to be concerned about?
No, that's inevitable. That's inevitable. Just as, you know, the way I conceptualize it is that as the brine gets denser and denser with microbial life, it just, you know, takes on a cloudy appearance. So, I mean, you know, in my experience, it's just absolutely normal. The brine always gets cloudy.
Okay. But you filled the jar up with cucumbers, added water, enough water to cover. And then salt or the salty.
Well, okay. So, you'll notice that in addition to cucumbers, you can see grape leaves there.
Yeah.
So grape leaves have tannins that help keep the cucumbers crunchy by inhibiting enzymes that can break down the pectins. And we've all eaten a mushy pickle. You know, cucumbers and any vegetables will, given enough time, you know, lose their firmness and get soft and mushy.
Yeah.
And that happens especially fast with watery summer vegetables like cucumbers or zucchini. And so, you know, a strategy for slowing this down, I mean, there's chemicals people use also, but, you know, I prefer to stay away from that and do it old world way. So, you know, at the edges of the clearing where I live, there's just grapevines hanging from trees. And every time I make pickles, I go out and pick some grapevines. Then I go out and pick some dill out of the garden. You know, I take some flowering heads and I take some seeds and I put them both in there. Then I take garlic. I don't even bother peeling the garlic. I just cut it in half and put it in with the peels. I usually, you know, for a jar this size, you know, there's at least a good head of garlic in there. And then meanwhile, I soak the cucumbers in ice water. That also helps maintain crispness. Uh-huh. And then before I put each one in, I use a little paring knife and scrape off any residue of the blossom at the blossom end. Every cucumber has a stem end and a blossom end. Uh-huh. And the blossoms have like a greater concentration of these enzymes that can make them soft and mushy. So I scrape away any residue of the blossom. Uh-huh. And then I pack the cucumbers in. And then, you know, just, you know, roughly calculating a little bit less than half the volume of the jar, I'll prepare brine at that. You know, you want to use as little brine as possible to cover the vegetables so as to not dilute the flavor. You know, for this, I probably mixed up like a liter of brine. You know, I like to work in metric because I'm aiming for a 5% brine. So with a liter of water, that means 5%. That means 50 grams of salt.
Right.
You know, it's you know, if you try to do it in the imperial system, you end up with all these crazy fractions. You know that as a baker.
You need something like this, a calculator. Too, but, you know, yeah.
And so then I pour the 5% brine over it. And then, you know, you can always adjust the saltiness. If you do, I just taste the brine the next day once the salt has absorbed into the cucumbers. And, you know, if it tastes a little too salty, I'll add a little bit of water. If it tastes not salty enough, I could add a little bit of salt. But, you know, that's my basic method. And then, I mean, in the heat of the South, I mean, I really just do it for, I leave it out of the refrigerator for 4 or 5 days. You know, I'm looking for visual change. I'm looking for the bright green of a cucumber to turn into this duller olive green color. And then I taste the brine, and then I just put it in the fridge before.
You're like me. You like your pickles good and sour. But my dad used to like what he called half dills, where it was still bright green. But they were clear. They were interrupted somewhere in the process where they were still bright green and crisp. But I always felt they tasted too much like a cucumber and not enough like a pickle.
Well, I mean, I think that this raises an important point, which is that all ferments exist along a spectrum. And, you know, you can ferment them longer and, you know, more fermentation byproducts, in this case, acid, will build up. You know, the same is true of a sourdough loaf. Like, you know, if you, you know, the longer you leave it, the more acidic it will become. And some people like a really very acidic loaf. Some people prefer a milder flavor. Same thing with pickles. Some people prefer like a strong sour flavor. Yeah. Some people prefer a milder flavor. What I learned with sauerkraut on my wild fermentation cross-country book tour. Yeah. I started my tour with all this like 2-month-old sauerkraut. And everywhere where I went, I'd give people taste of sauerkraut. And this Austrian woman, you know, her reaction to my 2-month-old sauerkraut was, "That's pretty good for coleslaw." And like, you know, she did not consider it to be strong enough to legitimately be called sauerkraut. Yeah. Then by the time I like got to the West Coast, down to San Diego, up to Seattle, on my way back, I ran out of my mature sauerkraut, but I was always doing little demonstrations. So one day I had to serve people like 3-day-old sauerkraut. And I felt embarrassed because it's not that sour after 3 days. Yeah. But so many people said, "That's the best sauerkraut I ever had in my life." Like, you know, I thought I didn't like sauerkraut, but that's delicious. And, you know, I would say that there's no virtue in fermenting something for 2 months if you're going to prefer the flavor of it after 3 or 4 days. And I just encourage people to, you know, to taste whatever it is they're fermenting, just taste it at intervals. So you can get a sense of the evolving flavor and figure out where along that spectrum of possibility you like it.
How do you keep your pickles below the waterline so that they don't get that, that mold?
Oh, I've got various little things, like, you know, people are making very clever little, like, this is a little glass weight that fits right inside of a mason jar. So this is a great tool to do. You know, maybe an old world version of that would be you find a little river stone and use that as a weight. Here's one. This is a different ferment that I'll show you. But, you know, some people are manufacturing this little plastic foldable disc that fits right inside the jar. And, you know, with a lot of processes, you know, this is a technical challenge, is holding things down. So, you know, with vegetables, a lot of times with sauerkraut, people save an outer leaf of the cabbage and, you know, use that heavy spine on an outer leaf and use that as like almost like a spring trapped under the shoulders of the jar to hold everything down. Sometimes if I have a really like fat carrot, I'll save the end of a carrot to push things down. So, I mean, there's a million improvisational ways that people can do this, or increasingly there are, you know, clever little gadgets that people are manufacturing.
Do you leave the jar open to the air, or do you put a lid on it?
Well, I usually put a lid on it because I've got all kinds of little flies around my
kitchen. Just to keep the flies out.
But, you know, then you have the burden of releasing pressure. So the advantage of leaving things open is that the pressure can relieve itself. The vast majority of fermentations do not require air or oxygen. I mean, in fact, if you ask a biologist what is fermentation, they're going to tell you it's anaerobic metabolism, the production of energy without oxygen, even though there are a large handful of foods and beverages we describe as fermented that require oxygen. I call these the oxymoronic ferments. So, you know, these would include vinegar, kombucha, tempeh, koji, there are processes that are microbial transformations of foods that require oxygen, but the vast majority do not. And the question of whether to cover or not really has more to do with the ability of carbon dioxide that's produced to escape rather than a necessity for air to get in.
So like even a piece of cheesecloth or a fine mesh to keep the bugs out could be just as good. As long as you keep
Sometimes I'll put a lid on loosely, like so I won't tighten it, and that way the pressure can get out. But even a loose lid sitting on top of a jar will generally keep the flies out.
I used to make pickles when I lived in Northern California in 5 gallon tubs, you know, and I would put plates to try to hold the water. But every once in a while, I noticed there would be some white, what looked like a white mold floating to the top. If I skim those out, my solution's not contaminated, is it, from those molds?
Yeah, no worry. I mean, it's more or less inevitable. The whole idea of getting vegetables submerged is to protect them from oxygen. But there's always a surface that's in contact with the oxygen, except in certain very cleverly engineered systems, which are all, you know, relatively, new. And a lot of those systems, I mean, anytime you open it up to look, smell, taste, you're letting the oxygen back in and defeating the purpose of your clever engineering.
Right.
So, you don't have to worry about it. I had a hilarious experience. I traveled to China 4 years ago with a Chinese American friend and her mother who lives in Hong Kong. We were trying to learn about Chinese fermentation, and we were learning about this amazing Sichuanese condiment called doubanzhang, which I have been making. It's a broad beans fermented with chili peppers. And we were like visiting the chef of this like 500 seat restaurant that's in the town where the doubanzhang is made and features all doubanzhang delicacies. And he had a pickle shack behind his restaurant. He wanted to show us his fermenting long beans. And he had all these big, like, you know, 100 liter clay crocks, but none of them had labels on them. And so he's opening up all these crocks and looking to see which one has the long beans. And they all have like white growth on top of them. Now, you know, a chef of a giant restaurant in the U.S., even if they had that, they would not let people videotape that. They don't want people to see the funk. But this guy was completely unselfconscious, and he was not even skimming it off to remove it. He was mixing it back in. Like, wow. You know, in his view, as someone who's been intimately connected to this process for his entire life, it was just so inevitable. It was just such a part of the process that's utterly harmless. And so, these are aerobic life forms that can develop on the surface. There's a yeast called a comm yeast. Sometimes you get a little hairy white mold. They're utterly harmless. I like to skim them off and remove them as best I can. Sometimes some of it just dissipates into the brine and you can't get all of it. Don't worry about it. It's not a big deal. Definitely don't throw away your pickles because you had a little funky growth.
I think that's the most important. Because I remember you the quote that I heard you say, which is that no one has ever been recorded to have gotten sick or ill or killed by eating fermented foods or something.
I mean, people, that's what people hear a lot. I say fermented vegetables. Fermented vegetables have 100% safety record. I mean, definitely in the history of cured meats and cheeses. I mean, you know, there have been problems, but it's only because these foods are, you know, high protein animal foods are a little bit more intrinsically dangerous than vegetable foods. The fermentation is a strategy for safety in either case, but in the realm of vegetables, there's just no case history anywhere of food poisoning or illness.
So don't be afraid to eat your pickles because they're not going to hurt you or any of your. So show us a couple of other. I think you got a couple other things to show us here.
Yeah. Sure. Okay. So this might be interesting to bread makers. This is a batter for dosas or idlis. So these are South Indian. A dosa is like a crepe, and a idli is a steam bread made in these little forms that you steam. And this is just basically lentils and rice. So I use red lentils because they're more easily available for me. And in India, most people would use urad dal, which is a white lentil with a black skin. But, you know, most of these processes are actually very, very flexible. So I soak them. Then I grind them up into a batter. With a little bit of salt. I leave them, you know, in hot weather, maybe 12 hours. In cool weather, it might be 24 to even 48 hours until it really doubles in size. And then I make crepes out of them. Usually I make the dosas. I love to make them for breakfast. Like I'll make a little crepe, flip it over, break an egg on top of it, put a little top on the pan so the egg cooks, and then put some sort of a little chutney or pesto or something on it and roll it up and have it for breakfast. So, you know, there's a lot of different bread concepts around the world. And, you know, wheat is not the only, grain that has yeast and bacteria. And, you know, you can do similar kinds of things with, you know, with rice, with millet, with all kinds of other grains. This is tempeh.
Oh, I love tempeh. Wait, before you start on the tempeh, I just want to go back to the dosa because I love dosas too, and I'm fascinated that you can make your own dosas this way. So that's like a dosa starter. Do you use that as a starter? Or do you make the dosas right from that batter?
No, this is the batter. I mean, there's no tradition of maintaining a starter over time.
And how long did it to get to that point to where it was fermented? A couple days?
The whole thing was 24 hours in the summer. Oh. You know, in warm weather in the summer. So I started soaking in the morning. In the afternoon, I took the soaked ingredients and I ground them down into a batter, added a little bit of salt to that, put it in the jar. And then in the morning, I made some doses. So it really just like fermented maybe for like 45 minutes. Nighttime.
Why that's happening, but my phone just has a mind of its own. This is the Zoom world we're in. That's cool. So now, can that also be used as a seed, let's say, as for a sourdough, if you want to add it to us to flour and water and use it as a seed to start a sourdough culture?
I mean, you could try it. I mean, I've never done that.
I mean, just thinking about
that. I don't know. I mean, it's it's a similar community of organisms. So I don't see any problem.
All right. Well, that's going on my list of things to try right away. All right, now I don't want to forget about that tempeh because that's a mystery food. It feeds an entire nation in Indonesia and Malaysia, but here in the United States, it's still kind of a niche food. So, can you explain a little bit about what tempeh is?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, traditionally tempeh is made from soybeans and, basically the soybeans are soaked and the first fermentation is the soaking. Lactic acid bacteria develops and that sort of, you know, gives, you know, helps protect the soybeans. Then you generally split them so that the skins will fall off of them and you'll have more surface area. And then you cook them, but only briefly. You cook them for maybe a half an hour, 45 minutes. You don't want them to get soft. You don't want them to lose their form. And by the way, I don't usually do this with soybeans. I mean, this one, I think I did black-eyed peas and black rice. So, you know, same idea, like, you know, soak, split, or the way I usually split them dry and then soak them, then cook them with black eyed peas. I only cook them for like 10 minutes because I don't want them to get soft. Then I mix it with the rice. You don't want things to be too wet because that really encourages, you know, bacterial growth and off flavors. So what I do is I cook the rice really dry so it will absorb any surface moisture off of the beans. Mm-hmm. And then I stir them as they're cooling and I need to get them down to like body temperature. And then I have a little a starter that's easy to buy through the internet, tempeh starter. It's a fungus called Rhizopus. So I sprinkle a little bit of the starter on my bean and rice mix and, you know, stir it for a couple of minutes to distribute it well. And then I basically take, you know, these plastic bags, which, you know, someone I know who had a business was throwing away. And I have a little hat pin. And I just make little holes in this because I want to hold most of the humidity inside, but allow for enough oxygen to support the growth of the fungus. And then I keep it in a warm environment. It's like 80 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So, I mean, on a hot summer day, I can just do it in the ambient temperature the way they do it in Indonesia and Malaysia. Yeah. But what I've done so I can make it all year around is I basically took a defunct commercial refrigerator and drilled some holes in the bottom and took the compressor off of the top. And then I just have an incandescent light bulb at the bottom and a little fixture and a little greenhouse temperature controller that it's plugged into at the top, you know, with a sensor at the top. So whenever the temperature gets like below 80 degrees, it turns the light bulb on. So I'm able to you know, maintain the target temperature range. And I use that same incubator also to make koji, which is this other kind of fungus, Aspergillus, grown on you know, grains or soybeans. And that's the starting point for making sake, for making miso, for making soy sauce, you know, a whole world of foods.
I was going to ask you, when you say the word fungal, so that moves us more into the yeast territory, because that's different from lactobacillus bacteria, right? So that's another kind of fermentation, a different category of fermentation.
There are lots of different kinds of fermentation. There's a lot. I mean, fermentation, you know, we use the word fermentation, you know, not necessarily in the way a biologist would use it, but to describe, you know, any kind of microbial transformation of food. And those microbes could be bacteria, they could be yeast, they could be molds. In many cases, they're combinations of all of them. I mean, you know, soy sauce, this ubiquitous condiment that's in everybody's kitchen, involves, you know, molds, bacteria, and yeasts.
So you're really deploying in fermentation, you're deploying these various organisms to transform a food from one thing into something else, or to preserve it.
I mean, so this was just like a loose, a loose bowl of beans and rice, and now it's become a cohesive thing that I slice. And fry. I mean, I marinate it in different things. I mean, I have lots of different ways that I like to cook it. And not all bacterial fermentations are acidic. I mean, certainly most of them and the most widely known ones are. I mean, like we have all our lactic acid ferments that would include, you know, sourdough bread, sauerkraut, pickles, and many other things. There's also acetic acid ferments, which are, you know, vinegars and kombucha and related things. But there actually are alkaline ferments, like bacteria that rather than producing acidic byproducts, produce alkaline byproducts.
Really?
So, for instance, I have right here natto. So this is a Japanese ferment. And, you know, it's like it's giving like a strong camembert kind of a smell. Because camembert also has like some alkaline byproducts that give it that like sort of ammonia notes. But this also creates like a slimy coating on the beans. So can you see any of these like little strings that are developing?
Yeah, they're coming through. Yeah.
So So, you know, this is something that I've really come to love the flavor of. I mean, the first time I tried it, I did not love the flavor of it. But, you know, I saw some other people taking such pleasure in it that I gave it another try and another. And now it has really become like a regular feature in my kitchen. But this is one that sort of, produces an alkaline byproduct rather than an acidic byproduct.
Very interesting, because that would be an acquired taste for most of us who tend to prefer things on the acidic side.
Well, I mean, a lot of ferments coffee, which is fermented, is an acquired taste. Beer, which is fermented, is an acquired taste. I mean, a lot of the flavors of ferment, I mean, Camembert cheese is an acquired taste. So, I mean, you know, that's something that's true sort of across cultures with fermentation.
So staying with the cheese category, so Camemberts and Brie, so cheeses that have that white mold coating around it, that's an alkaline alkaline forming microorganism.
Sure. And even if you get a white mold growing on your sauerkraut, the only danger with that is if you let it grow for a long time, it can consume some of the acids and make a more alkaline ferment. So yeah, a lot of the sort of, you know, white hairy molds will produce a more alkaline environment.
I'm kicking in a little bit of baking science. When you get alkaline and acid together in a liquid form, they usually neutralize and form carbon dioxide. Is that kind of what would happen if the alkaline mold starts to interact with the acid medium?
No, it's more that it's consuming lactic acid.
I see.
So it's not so much a reaction. It's not like, you know, baking soda and buttermilk.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's like, your mind can just spin off in a million directions with this, which I can see because all the different kinds of products that you're fermenting and the many ways in which you're fermenting them, it can become a passion. It can become a obsession almost. You know?
Let me show you one more kind of, vaguely bread related one.
Love it.
So I'm working on a new book, as long as I'm at home and can't, my life for the last 15 years has been a ton of traveling. I've taught in like 25 countries. I've done a lot of international traveling as well as domestic traveling. And obviously right now I'm not, but I'm writing a book that's like a, fermentation travelogue book about different things I've seen and learned about. And so I'm doing a lot of trying to refine my processes and get a little bit more nuanced in some of these things. But this is cassava, yuca. So in Ecuador, I tried something called yuca podrida, which translates as basically rotten cassava. And there's a lot of traditions around the world where people ferment their cassava. But this is just like I peeled the cassava, I cut it into chunks, and it's underwater. And I started this 2 days ago. I changed the water yesterday. After we're done with this, I'm going to change the water again. And then after another day or two, I'm going to steam these, mash them up, and make a dough to make like a tortilla de yuca. So bread concept, a flat bread concept from the fermented yuca, except, yuca has like one of the most like plain neutral flavors in the world. And the fermentation really like just gives it, an interesting flavor.
So to many of us, yuca, we think of tapioca as maybe the most common product that comes from the yuca. So this what you're doing is almost kind of like what they do with a hominy corn to turn corn into tortillas is the nixtamal or whatever they call it to alkalize it. And then you're doing it the opposite. You're acidifying it then by putting it into fermentation.
Yeah. By the way, I mean, Central America and South America actually are full of, people taking the nixtamal and then fermenting it. So there's a lot of like traditional, processes where you ferment the corn after it undergoes this process of nixtamalization.
Wow. Well, people in the foodie community is always asking the question, we've seen so much. What's next? Is there something else? You know, I've done this one. Now I want to move on to the next thing. And you can also, you can see the future of foods is lies in the past, because these traditional techniques are now, you know, you hear about something like this and you go, I can't wait to try something made from that, since I haven't, I'll be, you know, before. And then suddenly it becomes the hot new trendy item, you know? And so I could see something going, doing with the yuca, you know, doing that. What is the flavor like then? What, is it just like a bland bread? And is there any salt in that solution that you're
There's no salt in this solution. Although when I steam it and then mash it up, I'll certainly add some dough. So some salt into the dough.
Because I heard you say at a recent symposium that that salt's not really necessary for to ferment the cucumbers or the sauerkraut. It's just more for flavor. It's not because it protects the product or what?
Well, I mean, I would hate to eat the cucumbers fermented without salt personally, because they would turn into mush, because salt slows down those enzymes that I was talking about earlier.
So it's
all really just saying that salt is not absolutely essential. It's not the thing standing between, you know, you and something becoming dangerous to eat.
I get it.
But it has a lot of benefits.
So in this case,
there's even some health gurus out there telling people that they get sort of better probiotics from their sauerkraut if they don't use any salt. Lactic acid bacteria, which are the primary probiotics in sauerkraut, definitely can tolerate salt. So I absolutely disagree with this. But you know, there are people making salt-free sauerkraut. There was a brand called Rejuvenative Foods out of Santa Cruz, California, for decades that was marketing nationally a salt-free sauerkraut that wasn't very good, but but it wasn't making people sick.
They sold it on the health claim.
And there are some traditions. I mean, I visited a town called Kiso in Japan in a remote valley that traditionally didn't have access to a lot of salt. And so they developed a tradition of making a salt-free sauerkraut in Nepal and the sort of northern Himalayan area. They have traditions of fermenting without salt, but then they dry the vegetables for preservation. Like without salt, it becomes very hard to preserve things for long periods of time. Not that they'll become dangerous, but that they'll become mushy and unappealing. They'll decompose.
But in the case of the yuca, you want to mash it anyway, so it doesn't. You're not trying to keep it crisp, so you don't really need the salt.
And also, I'm only doing this for a few days. I'm not. This isn't a long-term fermentation. One thing, before we cut out, I want to just say that people sometimes talk about fermentation as a strategy for food preservation, and it is. It can be, but not every fermentation is for preservation. I mean, nobody's ever fermented wheat to preserve it. I mean, wheat preserves best if you just keep wheat berries or even flour. You know, once you add water, you're beginning a dynamic process. And so, grains and beans are never fermented in order to preserve them. They're fermented for flavor, for digestibility, for lightness and rising. I mean, there's a million other reasons that they're enhanced by the fermentation, but it's never to preserve them.
Well, I could talk about this all day with you, because I would never get tired of hearing, your wisdom. But we're scratching the surface of this huge category called fermentation, and the growing fermento community out there knows, what you're talking about, because they've been following you. The Art of Fermentation: An In-Depth Explanation of Essential Concepts and Processes is the more recent of your two books. The original book that came out 17-18 years ago, Wild Fermentation: The Flavor, Nutrition, and Craft of Live Culture Foods, are the two books that kind of put you on the fermentation map and got you all over the world. And I'm really looking forward to reading your, sounds like this next one's going to be more of a memoir, so to speak, a travelogue of your...
Well, I actually have two books coming out. I have one that's actually coming out in October.
Oh.
It's called Fermentation as Metaphor: which is, not really about how to ferment anything. And it's more, reflections on, how fermentation relates to some larger social processes as well. And that's against the backdrop of microscopy that I've been doing. So images of microorganisms. And then the one that I'm working on right now is like a fermentation travelogue. So, it's got recipes. My working title is Global Fermentation Inspiration. It's very impressionistic. It's just like the things I happen to have stumbled upon and learned about. I have lots of photos, lots of recipes. I hope that people will enjoy that.
I'm sure they will. I know publishers, especially when you get a reputation for owning a category, they want you to stay in that category. They don't want you to break out. And so they always want recipes, because if you've used recipes once, then you always have to have recipes. I've done the same thing with bread. I've written about bread as metaphor. That's been my theme. And that's why I love hearing the fermentation as metaphor, because we're kind of, we're running parallel tracks here. And so these worlds will converge. But every time I try to write a book about metaphor, the publisher always says, make sure you put in recipes. We've got to have so many recipes, because people want they want to make things from the book as well. So anyway, it's exciting. Thank you so much for sharing all your knowledge and showing us some really cool foods. We'll just stay in touch. Hopefully we can get you back as we continue this series of interviews. When the book comes out, after the book comes out, maybe we can get you back to talk more about specifically, what's in that book. So Sandor Katz, thank you for being on Pizza Talk today. Even though we didn't talk about pizza, we really did. We talked about what is the foundation of any great pizza, which is the fermented dough underneath it. So thanks so much. And thank you all for joining us on Pizza Talk. We'll see you on the next episode.
Thanks, Peter. It's a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Pizza Quest is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Thanks for listening.